The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So my name is Andrea Fella, and I've been away for 6 weeks teaching the long retreat at IMS in Massachusetts, the three-month course that's taught there each year. And so it's quite settling for me to do that, to be there working with the students who are there for 6 weeks or 3 months. And it's still continuing. I was there for the first half, for the first 6 weeks, and 85 people there practicing. And a couple days ago, half the people left, and another 45 people or so came. And so it's still continuing, that retreat, and people spending their time really looking at what's happening in their minds, in their hearts, in the present moment. And that's what I'd like to talk about tonight, the present moment. And we emphasize this a lot here in terms of mindfulness practice. Really what mindfulness is a quality that allows us to recognize what's happening in the present moment while it's happening. And so the practice or quality of mindfulness is directing us right into knowing what's happening in the present moment. And sometimes as we practice, we can get a little caught up in the technique of the practice of how can I be present and forget or lose touch with a little bit about why we do this. Why do we want to know what's happening in the present moment while it's happening? Sometimes being with our breath or our body, it's like, well, in, out. What does this have to do with anything? In, out, breathing. And certainly I see this on the long retreat sometimes. People kind of in the middle go, why am I here? What's going on? And so I just wanted to reflect on that a little bit. Why do we do this? Why do we cultivate this quality of mindfulness that allows us to meet the present moment? I think the first and perhaps most succinct reason we want to do this is because the present moment is the only place anything happens. We think sometimes that there's a past kind of back there somewhere or a future somewhere out there. Often we think of the past as behind us and the future ahead of us. And yet, what is the past? I mean, the past actually, you know, there was something that happened. There are conditions from our past that have kind of created who we are in this moment. And so there's a lot of conditioning that has fed into who we are, how we are right now in this moment, from things that happened to us before. But the past itself is not existent right now. It can arise in the present moment. There can be a thought about the past that arises in the present moment. But that's exactly what it is. It's a thought about the past arising right now. It's just a thought in the mind. It may have some connection to something that did happen at one point. But right now, in this moment, it is merely a thought. The future is a little bit more illusory because we can have thoughts about the future, but those are not related to what actually will happen. I mean, potentially they might be, but they're kind of just, you know, at least the thoughts about the past are related to something that possibly did happen. But the thoughts about the future are kind of completely constructed. And yet we live often in these thoughts about the past and the future. A lot of our life is spent in this planning kind of mode. What am I going to be doing? How am I going to be doing it? What will I be like when I'm doing it? A lot of these thoughts have me in the center of them, of course. And so we spend a lot of our moments of life, a lot of what's going on in our lives, lost in thoughts about the past or future, in these thought worlds or bubbles, almost little bubbles of reality that our mind creates and then takes up residence in. At one point, I saw this so clearly. I had been in a relationship with someone, and the relationship had been over for a couple of years. And I'd done a lot of work about the anger and the frustration and the hurt that had happened in the breakup of that relationship. And so there was no longer so much or even any real reactivity about that relationship. But at one point, I found myself walking down the street, and I woke up into a thought. And it was like the mind had taken up residence in its past ideas of that relationship, and it was as if it was living it right now. In that moment, I woke up, and there was such confusion. It's like, wait, no, I'm not in that relationship anymore. But it was very clear that for those moments where the mind was thinking about that past, it had believed that reality. And then as the mind woke up, it was like that bubble that the mind had created was burst. We live in this kind of reality so much, not in what's actually happening, but just in some thoughts or ideas. And so if we're not aware of what's happening in the present moment, and this is not to say that we have to become this non-thinking creature that is just kind of in awe in the present moment. Wow, things are happening. But it's useful to recognize when thoughts of the past happen that they are thoughts happening now. And then we can discern or determine whether they are useful thoughts. Likewise, thinking thoughts about the future. We need to plan. We have to plan. Our whole kind of organism, the human organism, is designed around this capacity and function of planning. And so it's necessary for us to live, to continue to survive as a species, to have this planning function. But when we're caught in planning and lost in it, believing that it is actually the reality in this moment, that is delusion. And it's useful to recognize, oh, planning's happening right now. Is this a useful kind of planning? Or is this a kind of just a fantasy? And so discerning whether that we are thinking in the present moment, this is not, we don't have to stop thinking, but becoming aware that we are thinking. And so this is one big part of why it's so useful to practice mindfulness, to cultivate mindfulness, because it helps us arrive in what is actually happening. It helps us wake up to our lives. If we're not mindful and aware in the present moment, it's like we're missing our lives. Another reason that it's useful to be present in the present moment, and this is a key kind of teaching around what the Buddha discovered in his own understanding of why it's useful to practice mindfulness. His whole journey was around a question of how does suffering happen? And is it possible for human beings to be free of suffering? And so this was his journey. This was his kind of quest. And in his teachings that he offered following his understanding or his freedom, his awakening, he pointed to there are things that will happen in our lives that are unpleasant. Things that people do that are unskillful, situations that arise. Sometimes they're called the eight worldly winds. Praise and blame, gain and loss, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute. These things will happen to all of us. And he even said, there's no one who will only be appraised in this world. In fact, there was somebody who came to the Buddha or came to the monastics and asked for a teaching, and one teacher gave a teaching that was a few sentences, and somebody said, well, that teaching was too short. And somebody else came and somebody gave a very long teaching, and somebody said, well, that teaching's too long. And so this is like, you know, the Goldilocks difficulty. This one's too long, this one's too short. And the Buddha, when hearing that, said, you know, this is just the nature of things. You know, nobody is going to find what we do. What we do is being only praiseworthy. There will be people that find fault with what we do. And so these worldly wins are going to happen. And yet, what we tend to think is that in order to be happy, I have to have the world in a certain configuration. I should only have people praising me. I should only have fame, never disrepute. I should only have pleasant stuff happening. I should only have gain, never loss. And that's the way that I can be happy. But the Buddha said, that's not going to happen. And so given that that's not going to happen, he was asking, is it possible to find ease of mind given that these things are going to go on? And in his own freedom, in his own awakening, he found, yes, it is possible. Because a lot of what we actually experience as suffering is not so much what's happening outside of us. It's not so much that people are blaming us or that there's unpleasant things happening. These things will affect us. But in our minds, there can be an ease or a peace that is not, that is at ease, content with just this moment, just things as they are in this moment. And that might not necessarily mean a contentment. Often when we hear peace or contentment, we think that what that means is that nothing has to change. Everything is okay the way it is. Or, you know, so this is an interesting exploration of what this peace means that the Buddha was talking about, because the Buddha as a teacher wasn't the kind of teacher who just sat there and kind of the remote top of the mountain guru kind of teacher. He was engaged. He was walking around India and talking to kings and standing in the middle of battlefields trying to stop water wars. He was engaged. And he was engaged in teaching to try to help people to understand what he learned. And so he was not simply saying, oh, things are perfect the way they are. But he was, my understanding is that he was perfectly at ease with things as they are and recognizing, and if this being acts in this way, it will support others to come to less suffering. And so he engaged in the world in that way. What will support beings to suffer less? And so his teaching encourages us to look at the present moment. And basically, this is another, what I'd say is one of the other key reasons for exploring the present moment. Because suffering, this kind of suffering that the Buddha pointed to that we can be free of, the reactivity, basically we suffer when we react to praise and blame, gain and loss, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute. When we react to it not being the way we want it to be, we suffer. It's like we add a level of suffering to our system. At one point, the Buddha said, it's as if someone who has been stabbed with a dart picks up another dart and stabs themselves with it through this reactivity. And it is this second dart, this second arrow, this reactivity to what is happening that we can be free of. And the experience, in my own experience, touching in a little bit with this in my meditation practice, seeing how even something like physical pain, very strong physical pain even, when experienced without reaction or aversion or hatred in the mind, it is a completely different thing. It does not even, it's not even experienced as pain, as what we call pain. It's experienced more as something like, wow, that's an unpleasant experience. And the mind is just at ease with that. And yet there's also the recognition of, I was sitting in a posture where there was some pain in my ankle bone, and I'm just realizing, wow, yeah, that's strong, unpleasant sensation. There was no reactivity in the mind about it. And at some point, there was the sense of, and it would be useful to move. Not out of aversion, but out of understanding what's supportive for this body and mind. And so the kind of suffering that we can be free of, and the vast majority of what we even think of as suffering, is created in the present moment. That may be hard to kind of grok, because so much of the conditions of our lives, and for myself, you know, a lot of self-negative thoughts, patterns and habits of self-hatred, you know, real deep feelings of unworthiness, and it didn't seem like it was just a present moment phenomenon. It really felt like it was like my past just being, you know, dragged with me somehow. Felt like it was always there. And yet, as I began to explore my mind, explore the patterns, the habits of my mind, I began to see that suffering is created now. So a couple of simple examples about this from my own practice. Most of these happen on retreat, but there's one of them that happened in just in daily life, in my everyday activities. So I want to offer that also as a possibility. It's not just on long retreat that this kind of understanding can happen. So on one retreat, I was noticing thoughts about something that had happened to me in the past. And so this is, you know, seeing thoughts arising about the past right now. And the particular thought that was coming up a lot was about a time I'd been in a play. I had a large role in a play, and at one point on one of the nights I forgot a line. And I tried, you know, ad-libbing a little bit, hoping that the other actors would pick up and realize, yeah, she doesn't remember her lines, let's move on. But nobody did, and so there was just silence, and it was really uncomfortable, really embarrassing. And that memory arose many times for me on this retreat. And each time it arose, there was so much embarrassment. And originally, it just felt almost like the thought and the embarrassment were the same thing. Like the memory of that thing happening and the embarrassment were just completely connected. And it almost felt like the embarrassment was kind of, you know, lurking somewhere in a storehouse there. And it was just like, well, that trapdoor was opened and there it is. There's that embarrassment. That's kind of how it felt at first. But as I kept watching and kept observing, I could see that, you know, I would be fine. I would be, you know, just content and comfortable, and then this memory would arise. And over time, I began to see how the memory was a trigger for thinking about what had happened. And as the on long retreat, sometimes we can, it's almost like things get slowed down a little bit. And I could see that there was this thought arising, and then this process of creating the embarrassment right there. It's like that the memory arose in the mind, and the mind recreated the embarrassment right then and there. It wasn't actually like a whole pool of embarrassment that was just waiting to be unveiled. It was actually being constructed right in the moment. That was pretty powerful to see that, because it helped to, like, for instance, right now I can talk about this and not experience embarrassment. In fact, it's kind of sweet to think about it and to remember this whole pain. There was so much suffering that I went through for weeks on this retreat when that memory came up. So much, many thoughts about, oh, I wish that had never happened. It's like, it happened. And now the thought can arise, and it's just like, oh yeah, that happened. So so that's seeing how the mind constructs the suffering, the extra. It's like there's extra stuff added in our minds when we think about the past. And this is, you know, very natural in a way. In some ways, when a memory comes up, so in that situation, the memory comes up of this is the situation that I was in. It's like, if I'm not aware that this is just a thought arising in the present moment, then the mind, you know, in that way of kind of creating the world and believing the world it is taken up residence in, it's like it's experiencing that event again, because it believes that it's happening in this moment. And so the thought arises, the mind believes it believes it's standing on the stage again and forgetting the line again. And in that situation, then embarrassment was constructed or arose in the mind, because it had taken up residence in that thought world. When we can recognize, oh, this is a thought that's arising, there's more. So this is being present in the present moment to recognize, oh, this is what's happening right now. There's a thought about the past arising in this moment. There's much more kind of space in the mind to not engage in that process of believing the thought to be a real experience. And there can be the conditions for the kind of creation of that suffering to not happen. So that's one story from my own experience. And after that point, actually, at a certain point, there was the really clear seeing, oh, this is just a thought, and this embarrassment is just being created kind of by believing this thought. And the seeing of that, I don't actually remember at that point whether the thoughts just started dying down and they just didn't happen so much anymore on that retreat, or whether if the thoughts arose, the embarrassment wasn't there so much. I don't remember. But in any case, there was the suffering around it went away, whether it was from the thought subsiding or whether it was from the embarrassment not arising. I don't remember at this point. And then another example from daily life. So this happened early in my practice. This was probably within the first 3 or 4 months of my practice. And I started in my practice by, I was not interested in meditation at all, first of all, but I was very interested in understanding my mind and the patterns and habits of my mind, which were so painful. So the suffering was really what brought me to practice. And anger was a big pattern that I was looking at, anger about that person who broke up with me. So that was the whole thing that got me into this practice in the first place, was the suffering related to that relationship ending. And there were a lot of other emotions around it too, loneliness and despair, all kinds of things. And my mind was in a state where it was not very able to deal with all of these emotions. So I was very motivated. Everything that I'd tried was not very helpful, and a friend sent me a book about mindfulness. And the book that my friend sent me was really kind of fortuitous, because it was more about a book about, it was called Everyday Zen. And so it was a little bit about meditation, but it also just talked about how to be aware of stuff in your daily life. And so that's what I was interested in. I wasn't interested in meditating, but I was interested in understanding my mind. And so I started just observing, watching what was going on around these emotions. And the key instruction that I picked out of this book was, when these emotions arise, just see if you can be aware of them. So this is aware of emotion in the present moment as emotion in the present moment. So this is coming back to this real simplicity of just knowing what's here in the present moment. And when I read that, I thought, what good is that going to do? Isn't that just going to make me more angry or more despairing or more depressed or more lonely to know that I'm lonely or despairing or depressed? Isn't that just going to do that? But as I said, it was like, nothing else has worked. I might as well give this a try. So that was what I did. I started with that, just, okay, well, I'll just see what happens if I try to know that I'm angry while I'm angry, or I'm lonely while I'm lonely. And so I was just kind of exploring that over the course of the first few months. And I did see quite a bit. It wasn't that long. It was probably 6 weeks or 2 months or so when I finally understood, oh, I see how this works. This creates the conditions for the mind to be able to kind of have a different relationship, to let go a little bit of these patterns and habits. But the example that I would want to talk about tonight is about loneliness. I wasn't really particularly trying to be mindful, like, oh, put the loneliness under a microscope. And I hadn't even had instructions about what it meant to be mindful of emotions. So it was kind of more just recognizing, okay, yep, anger's happening right now. Okay, loneliness is happening right now. And that's about all that I knew how to do with mindfulness at that point. And so, just noticing these patterns. And at one point, I began noticing a very, very regular recurring pattern around loneliness and going to bed at night. I got very lonely. Now, this did not surprise me. You know, it was, yeah, okay, broke up. Loneliness seems obvious here in this situation. And so I wasn't particularly surprised about it, but I was just like noticing, okay, yeah, there's loneliness. And it was just a very regular recurring pattern. I was just watching it each night and just continuing, just noticing it and going to bed. And then one night, while I was setting my alarm clock, I noticed that the loneliness started and seemed like it was connected somehow to setting the alarm clock. That got my interest. It's like, what on earth does loneliness have to do with setting an alarm clock? I had no idea. But again, I just kept going. And this was over many, many evenings, this exploration. Just going to bed at night, noticing the loneliness. And so here, you know, again, in being present, this wasn't something I was trying to find or trying to look for. I was just curious about, well, what's here? You know, okay, well, there's this loneliness here. And kind of getting familiar with the loneliness, basically, as I got familiar with it, I at some point saw very distinctly when it arose. Loneliness is not there. Loneliness is here. And so there's kind of a familiarity with the mind state that began to happen through this just very simple exercise or just practice of noticing this pattern that happened regularly in my life. And so seeing that it started with the alarm clock, that was curious, and then noticed that that continued a few nights in a row. And then while I was setting my alarm clock one night, I noticed that there was a thought in the mind. And that thought was related to my ex-partner, and we were together in Disneyland looking up at a marquee that had a digital clock on it. That was the memory that arose. And I could see that there was a connection between the memory and what I was doing. You know, this was conditioned, that there was kind of an associative link between the little clock that I was setting and the memory. And I also could tell the loneliness arose. I could tell that the loneliness was kind of in response to that memory, something along the lines of, I'll never be happy again. You know, I'll always be miserable. I'll always be alone. That kind of thought. You know, it's like, that was such a wonderful time. We had such good times together. Those will never happen again. That was what the mind was doing in reaction to that thought, that memory of being together with my partner. So that's what the mind was doing. So I could see this kind of unfolding. It's like alarm clock, memory, reaction to memory. And the other thing that was so interesting there was that the loneliness was very different than what I had envisioned or thought that the loneliness was about. I thought the loneliness was about going to bed by myself. But what was going on was this memory and these thoughts about I'll never have good times again. So that was kind of startling, that was what was happening in the mind. What was even more startling was the next night when I set my alarm clock. It was like having seen that process at work, when the thought arose, which it did, I mean, having clearly seen it the night before, I remembered it, and it's like, yeah, there's that thought, and the loneliness did not arise. It stopped. That regular, I'm not saying I didn't get lonely again about that relationship even, but that regular every night going to bed lonely stopped. It was like the seeing in the present moment of these conditions, of how that suffering was constructed in the present moment. It was like having seen the mechanism at work. The mind just didn't go there. It just didn't go there anymore. So this is one of those experiences that was kind of like, yeah, this is really useful stuff. I think I'll keep going here with this. So from my initial kind of sense of, I don't know how this is going to work, a few experiences over the first few months of my practice in just daily life helped me to see, yes, it is useful to be attentive to what's happening in the present moment. It is useful to know this is what's arising. There's anger arising. There's frustration arising. There's confusion arising. It's useful to see that as something that's happening in the present moment. Not as something that we have to figure out how to do anything with. That was the key there, because the instruction was not to do anything, but just recognize it. Just recognizing it was so powerful. So this is one of the big reasons why we explore being in the present moment. We begin to see how our suffering, the ways that our mind contributes to suffering, we begin to see that, and with that, essentially, the mind begins to let go of those patterns, of those habits. The mind starts to let go of the ways that it creates suffering, the ways that it adds to praise and blame, gain and loss, fame and disrepute, pleasure and pain. Those things will happen, but the extra dart, the extra arrow, that does not have to happen. And so, you know, how does mindfulness do this? I mean, it's, as I said, you know, I didn't quite see how it would work when I got read that book, it's like, I don't get how that would work. And so in my years of practice, I have come up with a kind of an understanding for myself of why this works, of how this works. Why does paying attention to our suffering in the present moment help the mind to let go of it instead of kind of getting it like further stuck in it? So this is my own understanding, and it's I sometimes call this the magic power of mindfulness, because when we are mindful in the present moment of how the mind is constricted and stuck and reactive to what's happening, essentially when we're aware of reactive emotions, holding it with, okay, this is what's happening, this is what's arising, anger's arising, confusion's arising, frustration's arising. When we explore that, when we open to that with mindfulness, it creates the conditions for those reactions, that reactivity to weaken. And when we pay attention, you might think that basically being mindful of anything would create a weakening of it, but when we are attentive to beautiful qualities of mind, qualities of heart that are indicative or connected to a heart that's not constricted. And so if we pay attention and notice generosity and patience and love and compassion, when those happen, it creates the conditions for them to appear more frequently in our minds. And so those reactive emotions weaken and the beautiful emotions strengthen with the same practice, just being aware. So we can become aware of like the quality of generosity in our hearts, the way it feels. We can be aware of, this is generosity arising right now, or this is compassion arising right now. And that creates the conditions for more compassion to arise, for more generosity to arise. The way this seems to work is that when we are mindful of reactivity, when we're mindful of anger, for instance, or loneliness, or despair, confusion, when we're aware of that as something that's arising in the present moment, we understand that it is painful and suffering in the present moment. Now that sounds like maybe it's obvious, but our minds don't usually really clearly recognize that something like anger is painful here and now. That was actually another one of those insights I had early on in my practice, recognizing this anger that was arising for me. Actually, I was in the Peace Corps, so I was, 7,000 miles away from California, a little island in the South Pacific, and the person I was angry with was living in California, and I was really angry at the person. And as I watched the anger, at a certain point I could see that there was this belief or kind of commitment in the mind around this anger, that this anger is really going to make this person miserable. And, being 7,000 miles away, it kind of was really clear that this was, that person didn't even know I was angry. There was no way this anger was going to make that person miserable. And it was humbling to see that that's what the mind wanted to do, was make the other person miserable. But, just the recognition of, wow, this whole, idea of, I'm going to get something out of this anger. So the mind, again, living in that emotional kind of realm, believed that this was serving me in some way, believed that it was helping me in some way. And again, seeing that, wow, actually it got really clear to me, this is not making the other person miserable, but it hurts this hurts here, this hurts me. And so we see that with mindfulness. When we open to these reactive emotions with mindfulness, we feel the suffering of them here and now. We are no longer in a state of delusion where we're believing that these reactions are somehow helping us. And that is actually really good news. It doesn't sound like it, but it's really good news. Because when we're bought into the story or the delusion of anger or greed, of, yeah, that thing, I get rid of that thing, then I'll be happy, or get that thing, then I'll be happy. When we're bought into that story, we are missing that we are actually suffering here and now. We are not aware of that. And so the turning with mindfulness to this helps the mind to begin to recognize, oh, this isn't so helpful, actually. And this, the mind actually begins to recognize, too, that this is constructed by itself, that it's optional, that it doesn't have to do this. So this is what can be revealed by opening to our painful, reactive emotions with mindfulness. We feel the suffering of it in the present moment. And that, essentially, my understanding here is that creates the conditions for our system, our organism, basically, to begin to let go of the reactivity. Because our organism, my senses, and hearing from neurobiologists about kind of the evolution of all life, basically, there's a kind of a movement that our system wants to move towards well-being, or wants to move towards a kind of an even keel kind of state. And yet the way our own minds are constructed, thoughts and delusion can get in the mix in how we think that kind of even keel is created. And so we are living in a delusional idea of how we can have a kind of evenness or happiness in our lives. And when the mind begins to recognize that whole process that we had picked up, basically views from our culture, views from you know, what we're trained and taught with, that these views are kind of deceiving the mind, then the mindfulness begins to get, kind of like it gets a different education. Our system begins to understand that the way that it has been going about looking for that even keel is not really a very useful way. And so, again, our system then begins to figure out how to let go, how to reorient, how to engage differently. So much of my experience in the mindfulness has really been kind of settling back and allowing the system to learn from its experience. To learn this, when this arises, this is suffering. And likewise, when we feel the arising of love and compassion and patience and generosity, there's a quality in the heart that the heart knows when it's mindful of that, it knows this is the way. And so there, it's almost like our system, our organism has a leaning or a biological bent towards freedom when we give it the information that's available in the present moment through being mindful in the present moment. I had 3 pages of notes and I got through 1 page of notes. So there's about, 8 or 9 minutes. I just want to see if there's any, I want to just stop at this point and see if there's any comments or questions or thoughts or reflections on anything that I've shared or anything that it may connect to in your lives. Yeah.
Thank you, Andrea. My name is Ek. First of all, I will thank you for a wonderful talk tonight. Something really touched my heart was the way you said our mind have a natural tendency for a well-being. But when we are caught up in our views and the mind works for a well-being from that perspective.
Yes.
And when we can show the mind that this is something really, then mind itself figure out.
That's my experience. The mind figures, yes.
Wonderful.
It is wonderful. It is so wonderful. We think, even in our practice, you know, we sometimes think we have to figure out how to let go of these views. And in my experience, it's much more about letting the mind learn and understand, and the mind figures out how to let go. It's really great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm happy to open it to any kind of question about meditation or, yeah.
So during a retreat, all this stuff comes up. Figure a few things out. Maybe let go. How about concentration? Actually following the breath.
Mm-hmm.
It's still hard for me.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
That was on page 2. Didn't quite get there. So I'll say a few words about it. Yeah, concentration is another thing that happens in the present moment. And that that capacity of ours to kind of settle or stay with one experience can be also really helpful for us. You know, it can give us kind of a flavor of what the mind is like when it's not reactive. You know, it's lovely because, well, concentration, actually the definition of concentration is the state in which the five hindrances, which are five kind of reactive states, these five hindrances of sense pleasure and ill will and sleepiness and restlessness and doubt are not arising. And so that when the mind is in that state, it's got a little bit of the taste of what it's like to not be reactive. And so it's a lovely place to kind of touch into that possibility. And we're also encouraging wholesome qualities there. Sometimes when concentration happens, we're experiencing some other beautiful states. And so it's lovely, this happiness of seclusion from these hindrances. And yet for many of us too, it is challenging. It's not an easy thing for some minds. Other minds, I mean, I'd say roughly a third of the minds, this is just my own sense based on talking to people, roughly a third of people have a real, almost like natural inclination to just settle with one thing. And they just can just do that. And then say about a third of the people, that's more challenging, and they may have a little bit more of an inclination to just kind of know moment to moment what's happening, you know, just kind of more open awareness may be a little bit easier for them. And then there's about a third of the people that are kind of in the middle, equally hard or equally difficult, equally easy, both of them. I would say that for myself, you know, the the concentration was not difficult, but it was really bound up with a lot of unhelpful tendencies, because the concentration that I had some skill with in my life was bound up in my identity and being a good programmer and, you know, just a whole bunch of almost forceful ways towards concentration. And so that was not a very useful way for me to practice. And so experimenting with the more open awareness began to really open a lot of doorways for me. And so sometimes we might have the idea, we hear a lot about concentration, and concentration can, I mean, we hear it described, it's pleasant, it creates stability in the mind. And so we might think we want that, and we might think that we need that in order to learn about our minds and learn about freedom, this kind of gravitation towards well-being. But in my own experience, as I shifted away from concentration more towards this open awareness, I began to learn the possibility of a concentration that's available through the steadiness of mindfulness on many different experiences, so that it's not, you know, the staying with one experience, just staying with the breath, that wasn't what my mind kind of was gravitating to. It was aware of a sound, and then a body sensation, and then another sound, and then a mood for a little while, and then it would go back to a breath, and then another body sensation. It was just continual change. And that that it feels a little different than the stability of concentration on one object, but the hindrances can also fade there, and so you still get a flavor of the mind in, you know, without the hindrances there.
So is what you just described is not tight focus, one-pointed
on one breath, experience, yes.
But it's sensations or experiences
as they arise, as they come and go. And if
but,
you...
But
you,
it's not papancha.
It's not papancha. I mean, that's, I think, one thing that people do say when I've instructed people to let go of the one object and open to many things. People think, well, my mind's all over the place. And I ask, well, are you aware of all of the things? And they say yes. It can sometimes just take a little bit of kind of mental adjustment to, oh, this is a different kind of concentration.
So the kind you just described can be maybe a gateway.
It is absolutely a gateway. It can be a gateway to the more tightly focused concentration, but it can also be a direct gateway to insight.
Yes.
Right insight. We do not need that tight focused concentration for insight to arise.
Yes, I see.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's time to stop. So thank you for your attention.